just a moment while everybody finishes signing in here. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal, Mr. Beers?
4 minutes, Your Honor.
4 minutes. You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Paul Beers. I represent the appellant, Gene Anthony Brown. I did not represent him in the trial below. I appreciate the court appointing me to represent him on this appeal. It's a very interesting appeal. I think it's a very important issue. The issue basically is, in this case, did the trial court err in removing a regular sworn juror mid-trial, actually at the end of the case, and substituting in her place the designated additional juror, what we colloquially call the alternate? And secondly, if he did err, is that reversible error? Those are the two issues in the case, I think. And on the first issue, I think the parties are in agreement as to the legal standard. This is a statutory standard, and it's codified in 801.36.
Well, what is our standard of review?
Standard of review is abuse of discretion. I think the parties agree on that. But the standard here is for cause. A sworn juror is not fungible with the designated alternate. There must be cause. The trial court must find cause to remove a sworn juror, particularly when, as in this case, it was over the defense counsel's repeated objection.
Why wouldn't good cause be established by the, I think the court was interpreting this as feelings of intimidation or potential intimidation that could adversely affect the neutrality of the juror? Why wouldn't that be good cause?
Well, Your Honor, the trial court never said that. And in this context, cause has a specific statutory meaning, and that is an inability to continue to serve. I mean, that's essentially what 801.361 says. It has to be an inability to continue to discharge her sworn obligations. And there are two legal principles that come into play here. Number one, there's a presumption, a towering presumption in favor of that juror can continue to discharge her sworn obligations. Our Supreme Court said that as recently as 2012 in the Gallenbeck case. It's 283 Virginia 500 and Pacific 506. It's cited in my brief. So that's the first presumption the Commonwealth, as the moving party below, had to overcome. The second issue is, even if the Commonwealth raises some doubts about the juror's ability and fitness to continue to serve, any doubts have to be resolved in favor of the defendant when he objects to removal of a juror. In this case, Your Honor, the Commonwealth did not come close to overcoming the presumption, did not come close to meeting its burden. All this juror said was that a young girl approached her during the lunch break and said, don't you live on the same street as my grandparents? And the juror recognized her after a few minutes and put two and two together. We don't know the age of the young girl. We don't know her relationship to the defendant. The juror perceived that she was in, quote, the defendant's party and group. But we don't know there's no explanation who this young girl is. That juror did tell the court, when the court called her out, that it made her nervous. That's what she said. It made her nervous that someone knows where I live. This is not an anonymous jury. The jurors' names were announced to everybody. All the jurors' names are announced in this case. She said it made her nervous that someone might know where she lives. She also said she was able to continue to serve. I mean, the judge asked her quite pointedly, pages 94 and 95 of the transcript, if I admonish the parties to tell their friends and relatives not to contact jurors, are you able to continue? She said yes. She said yes. And she was asked again on the third day of trial, and he said, are you distracted in any way, Ms. Brooks? And she said no. She said, no, that's on pages 524 and 525. So he gave her every opportunity to say she couldn't continue to serve. She assured the court unequivocally she was not distracted and that she could continue to serve. So the presumption was not overcome. It was not overcome, and the trial court erred in removing this sworn juror and replacing her with the alternate over the defendant's objection. So the second issue in the case is that reversible error? And there, that's where the parties really part ways in terms of the legal standard. The legal standard the defense is urging this court to accept, and I think really confirm, really was articulated in 2000 in Commonwealth versus Winston, which I cite about six times in my brief, and the Commonwealth completely ignores in its brief. In that case, the court said that when it comes to a violation of the jury impanelment statutes, we observe a strict enforcement mandatory standard and a presumed prejudice standard. If I could just read the court two sentences from the holding. In that case, this court said, the principle is ancient that the statutory requirements for impaneling jurors are mandatory. Thus, any departure from a strict observance of the statutory provisions when done over the protest of the accused constitutes reversible error.
Remind me the facts in Winston of the replacement of the juror.
Yes, Your Honor. In that case, the trial judge excused three jurors for cause. And then she realized that before everyone had left, that she was down to 19 jurors. And the statute requires the trial judge to have 20 jurors free of exception and who stand indifferent to the cause. So she was in a predicament, and the Commonwealth raised its hand and said, tell you what we'll do, if you'll just put one of them back on, we will immediately exercise our peremptory strike, and so there's no harm to the defendant.
So that was a case of the initial selection of the juror.
That is correct, Judge.
Now, and I don't know the answer to this question, but this is a case where the replacement juror is actually a juror that was selected to hear the case, albeit as an alternate.
Yes, Your Honor.
There doesn't seem to be any cases or any guidance to trial courts on when they can replace a one juror with an alternate juror.
I disagree, Judge, respectfully. I think our case law has said that we apply 801-361, which adopts a for-cause standard.
Well, 801-361, though, mm-hmm. it seems to apply to bringing a new juror in to replace a non-sworn juror to replace a sworn juror.
I understand.
Here we're replacing a sworn juror with another sworn juror.
It does say that the court could bring in a sworn juror, but I think it's been construed by this court and I think the Supreme Court to apply in this situation that you can remove a sworn juror but only for cause. I think this court has said that a couple times in the cases I've cited in our brief. That is the closest statute, and I think it's been construed broadly to apply to this situation. And cause, again, in this context means...
Excuse me a moment.
Yes, sir.
You think it has applied in this situation, or you know it has applied in this situation, these circumstances? By the way, I have a related question. Some of the cases you are relying on have
yes,
to
sure.
do with forcing the defendant to use peremptory strikes, and in those cases, I'm not sure you. I think you get much more easily as to the inapplicability of harmless error.
Yes, Your Honor.
You can't do that. But
as far as the court's first question, for example, Wadler versus Commonwealth, 50 VA Appeal 113, pinpoint site 116, 2007.
In Wadler, what happened?
Gosh, Judge, I apologize. I can't remember the facts, but the holding is that the code 801-361
yes.
discusses how to replace a juror after the jury has been sworn. Discusses how to replace a juror after the jury has been sworn.
I thought that what happened here was consistent with what I understand. I don't know if it's consistent with Wadler, but as I understand the law, I didn't see there was a violation in the replacement part of this issue.
There's a violation because Juror Brooks should never have been removed because there was not statutory cause.
So is that what Wadler speaks to?
Wadler makes clear that 361 discusses how to replace a juror after the jury has been sworn.
But 361 authorizes the court, again, to cause another qualified juror to be sworn in his place. Here, that didn't occur. These jurors were chosen under 801-360.
Yes, sir.
Which talks about additional jurors, not alternate jurors.
Yes, sir.
And so we're dealing with replacement by a juror that was found free from cause and not struck by the, not objected to by the defendant, and drawn by lot. I mean, this is a, the It does require the judge to identify the additional jurors prior to trial, but I don't see what difference there is between the additional juror and the juror that was replaced.
Well, Judge, Strickler versus Commonwealth, which is a Supreme Court of Virginia case from 1991, 241 Virginia 482, says that pursuant to 801-360, which is what the court just pointed out, and quote, alternate juror, it's additional, but alternate juror may replace a juror excused for good cause during trial. Those two statutes have been construed, 360 and 361, to apply to this situation. When can you remove, over a defendant's objection, a sworn juror? Simply because there's an additional or alternate juror on the scene does not change the statutory standard. And Winston did not involve a peremptory strike exercised by the defense.
It relied on Kudjoe, that did rely on the peremptory strike.
Kudjoe came after.
I mean, Kudjoe came after, but
yes, sir.
Kudjoe
yes,
used Winston and cited to another case that involved a peremptory strike.
Kudjoe has been overruled, abrogated by the Supreme Court of Virginia in 2010, and that's important. I'm glad the court raised that. Our Supreme Court in 2010, in CSX case, said you had it right, that Winston's correct, Kudjoe's wrong. So I think that that.
They do that to us periodically.
Well, Judge, Winston is on point. I don't know how much time I have left, but.
Yes, you're into your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. This concludes my
session. I apologize for not mentioning that.
Good morning. May it please the court. Susan Harris for the Commonwealth. In my mind, this case is very simple. It has to do with whether or not, and I do agree with the defendant, that the standard of review is abuse of discretion. As I pointed out on brief, from the Lawler case recently, the abuse of discretion standard draws a line, or rather demarcates a region between the unsupportable and the merely mistaken, between the legal error, disorder of reason, severe lapse of judgment, and procedural failure that a reviewing court may always correct, and the simple disagreement that on this standard it may not. And while on the one hand the defendant speaks of the abuse of discretion as the standard of review, on brief, and even when he's up here arguing, he talks about how the court should apply a compelling standard for cause to remove a juror, and it seems to be advocating that the court almost apply the Remner, remember that Remner versus United States line of cases that have to do with the presumption of prejudice falling on the Commonwealth and when there's a third party influence on the a juror. We're simply not there. The analytical flaw that from which the defendant operates is that this has to do with a purported error of retaining of a qualified or releasing a qualified juror and bringing on another qualified juror. Cases that he cites as authority against what the judge did here are not applicable. Winston is a peremptory strike case.
And it was embraced again in CSX.
Well,
it
in that case,
it was approved. They were talking about peremptory strikes.
In that case, that was also a City of Richmond case, and in that case, I think there was a per se disqualification because a stockholder, because you know, per se disqualifications are looked on unfavorably in Virginia, but there are certain ones that are still. You know, you've got to toe the line. And in this one, there was a
shareholder
in the CSX, and the defendant had to use or the prosecutor, I don't remember, had to use one of their peremptory strikes to get rid of the, and you cannot do that. And all this language about, you know, that the defendant cites about, and I completely agree that the trial court must resolve any doubts about the juror's impartiality in favor of the defendant is valid. But the cases that he cites, as I argue on brief, speak to the issue of a court abusing its discretion when it retains a juror, releases one.
Do you agree that the court, in order to replace one juror with an alternate or additional juror, must find that the replaced juror is unable from any cause to perform his duty?
I don't like the sound of that, any cause.
Well, it comes out of the statute.
Okay. So. Well, it says any cause, but I don't like the gloss of compelling. The point is.
Well, what is the evidentiary threshold that the court must meet before he can excuse a regular juror without abusing discretion?
Well, I think good cause. I'm not going to argue about that, but I think that the judge here made it abundantly clear that he believed, and he's the one closest to the heartbeat. He's the one down there.
So, despite all of our arguments about peremptory strikes versus additional jurors, this case comes down. And don't let me put words in your mouth, but does it come down to simply, was there good cause to excuse the juror?
Yes, sir. And whether or not we have confidence in this trial judge who was down there, as I say, in the trench, saw the witnesses, saw Miss Brooks, and made a determination that the prosecutor's motion was legitimate, and that the concern that she may be deciding the case on something other than the evidence. And I also agree with the defendant that she was willing to soldier on and, you know, gut it out. But the judge talked to her over 3 days and thought, you know, she kept saying, she was kind of talking out of both sides of her mouth. She's saying, I live near the scene where Officer Orange was murdered, executed. I live close by. I'm a single parent. I live alone. I don't want any trouble. And he made a determination that, and this is the way he handled it. And I...
Is the good cause to discharge an impaneled juror the same level of good cause necessary to excuse a juror for cause? If this had been prior to the jury having been sworn, and this juror said these things, and the trial court said, I'm going to excuse you for cause, would we apply the same analysis to determine whether that was error?
Well, Judge, remember there was a recent case about that, Garcia? And it was the very same issue. And this court ruled that the court did not err in refusing to strike for cause a juror who said...
No, I'm not talking about refusing to strike for cause. If the judge had struck this juror for cause and the defendant objected based on the exact same testimony, would we look at it the same way? I'm trying to decide whether there's any difference in the analysis depending on whether the juror is being voir dired in the first instance or being voir dired after having been impaneled.
I don't see a difference, Judge. Yes. I mean, we could talk about it, but I don't see a difference. And I as I say, the analytical flaw in this whole case is that the case law that's being bandied about is not applicable in this set of circumstances. Also, some of the cases, other cases that are cited in the defendant's brief, a couple of cases from Washington, D.C., and then one from Montana. But their situations are entirely different from Virginia's. In those cases where the judge got rid of a sitting juror and replaced it with an alternate, one case that comes to mind is in Washington, they have this practice where after the lawyers finish examining the witnesses, the jurors get to examine the witnesses. Oh. And so in both of those cases, the defendant cites as authority for another analysis, the judge, I guess, became... in one case, the judge said, well, this woman, because she submitted like 43 questions to the witness, and she was, making a nuisance of herself. And they said that the judge released her, replaced her with an alternate because she was a hung jury waiting to happen. I mean, that's not what we have in this case. Another one was replaced with an alternate because his hygiene was bad. That's not what we have in this case. Those are silly reasons. This woman was uneasy, and although she was trying to be strong and soldier on, as I say, the judge exercises discretion, which 8.01.361 allows him to do, and I believe that the conviction should be affirmed. And if there are any questions, I would ask you to do that.
I just want one more.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm trying to decide what to make, if anything, of the fact that at the motion for the mistrial that was made, right, in this case.
Yes, ma'am.
The defense conceded that, the way it was argued, that this juror had tainted the whole jury.
Yes, ma'am.
Because she had open discussions with the jury about her feelings of discomfort. And it's right in the record. It seems to me it goes to the idea that the judge had that very same concern, that if she were left on the jury during deliberations, she would continue discussing her discomfort.
Well,
do we use that as part of supporting what the judge did in this case when he discharged the one and replaced?
I don't know, Judge. It's hard to say, but I would just point out that as far as a taint that the defendant is...
I'm not saying the jury was tainted.
Okay.
I'm just saying the defense conceded that this juror at least had already, he argued, this is a juror that could taint the whole jury.
So that's a friendly question, you're saying? Yes. Yes, I agree. I agree, yes. Yes, I think that could be part of the analysis.
I mean, the defense says that.
And I think
he's concerned about the continuing presence.
Yes, ma'am.
Because he asked for mistrial on that ground.
Yes, ma'am. That's right.
Thank you, Ms. Harris.
Thank you.
Mr. Beers, I would be curious how you would respond to Judge Petty's question about whether there's a difference in excusing a prospective juror for cause during the jury selection process versus what we have here.
Yes, Your Honor, it's the same standard. This court has held that, for example, in Hunt versus Commonwealth 25 VA appeal, pinpoint site is at 399. It said the same standard applies when a jury's impartiality is challenged mid-trial to when we look at it before trial. That is, you know, that they cannot be an objective fact finder. They can't be impartial. That's a very difficult showing for anyone to make. The Commonwealth did not make it. This lady told Judge Apgar repeatedly she could continue on this jury. And to answer Her Honor's question.
Well, could she continue on this jury and taint it?
No.
Is the question.
No, she wasn't going to taint it.
Well, you made the argument, or somebody made the argument.
The defense counsel said in the alternative, if you're going to overrule my and kick off this lady, then I want a mistrial, because if she's tainted to such an extent, I guess they are. So he argued that in the alternative. What the judge asked her is, have you talked to her? When he called her out for the second time, he said, have you brought this up with the jury since the first day of trial? That's the first lunch break. Here he is on day three. And she said no. And then he instructed her, well, so no one's asked about it? It hasn't been discussed again? No, there's been no problem. And so he said, well, probably best you not bring it up again. And she said, I won't. She never asked to be removed.
And then he left her on the jury until the conclusion of the case.
We left her on jury until he said you can now start deliberating, even though the statute 360 says it's got to be before final submission of the jury. It's another problem.
You know, I don't know that this helps us much, but let me ask a question anyway.
Yes, Your Honor.
In that Lawler case that I believe was mentioned, the Supreme Court talks about abuse of discretion. And it said there's three ways considering irrelevant, improper factors. But the one that seems to be considered apply here is the court considers all proper factors, no improper ones, but in weighing those factors commits a clear error of judgment. Is that what we have to conclude, that there's a clear error of judgment here?
There's a clear error of judgment. There's an error of law. And an error of law, by definition, is an abuse of discretion. He applied the wrong standard. There's a presumption in favor of Dura Brooks that she could continue.
Well, it's not if it's an abuse of discretion, your argument is that the cause wasn't good. That's an error of judgment.
I think it's even clearer than that, Judge. He entered two orders in this case, as well as his comments on the record about this. He never found cause. He never said he found cause. He never articulated what the cause was. That she's nervous on the first day of trial, that someone knows where she lives. I mean, it was a murder trial. I mean, everyone's nervous. Everyone on the jury's nervous about that. It's just no cause. It didn't come close to overcoming the presumption that this sworn juror could continue. She told the judge she could continue repeatedly. Am I out of time, Judge?
You've got enough time to sum it up real quick.
I just asked the court to look. She talked about Washington, D.C. Let me say that there's an en banc decision by the Court of Appeals of the District of Columbia that is the most thoughtful and in-depth analysis anywhere on this very subject that we're talking about. And I asked the court to look at that. Because I think it fully supports Mr. Brown's both his request that these convictions be vacated and to be given a new trial. There was a clear error of law here. Prejudice is presumed, and even if it's not presumed, there's harmful error. And I'll finally point out they haven't even raised the harmless error doctrine in their brief, so they can't do it now. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much.